And it's time for The Rest is History, when we look back into the week's news in the past. And this week, we're going to be just a tiny bit sacrilegious. Our resident historian Robert Kelly is looking back to the first screening on the BBC of Monty Python's Flying Circus, first transmitted at 10:50pm on October 5th, 1969, so just a little over 50 years. And Robert's also going to touch on the impact that British comedy had here in New Zealand. Hi Robert, this week in history, as I said, just over 50 years ago, the BBC boldly put Monty Python to air.
Yeah, and a lot of people within the organisation weren't too happy about it, but they really kicked off straight from the beginning with some classics, including the world's funniest joke.
A scribbler, writer of jokes. In a few moments, he will have written the funniest joke in the world, and as a consequence, he will die laughing. It was obvious that this joke was lethal. No one could read it and live.
That was from episode one, which they wanted to call program two.
Yeah, which is a great gag. It in the end ended up being called Wither Canada for really no discernible reason. It appears to be just another gag. They were so frustrated about not being able to call anything what they wanted to call it that they did everything they could to frustrate the BBC management, who, it appears, were incredibly frustrated by them.
Who were Monty Python?
Monty Python were a group of male British comedians, Graham Chapman, John Cleese, Terry Gilliam, Eric Idle, Terry Jones and Michael Palin. One of the Terrys, of course, was from the US. They were a kind of a group of writers, and the fact that we got the combination that we did for that is a bit of a surprise. It almost didn't work. There were all of these different things that were getting in the way. They were a pair of writing partnerships, and then other people came in. Eric Idle quite famously liked to write by himself. Graham Chapman and John Cleese wrote together, and Michael Palin and Terry Jones wrote together. But as they worked out what their different systems were, they would come together after several days of writing and try and work out what they all thought was funny. And apparently they were incredibly ruthless about each other's copy.
I bet.
Can you imagine that writer's room? Like, it would have just been terrifying, I think, to put anything up. But when anything did work, they were all extremely enthusiastic about it. And the papers that have been released from the BBC do show this really interesting thing where none of them were particularly worried about who they played as actors because they all considered themselves as writers first. So they cast who they thought would be best rather than based around the ego of the performer, which I think probably is one of the reasons why the sketches are so enduring.
What was, I'm sorry I'll read that again, John Cleese, it was a radio show?
Yeah, it's one of my absolute favourites. I'm sorry I'll read that again came out of the Cambridge Footlights tradition. And it was a radio show fairly in the same vein. It was sketch comedy, a lot of very silly characters, and it really bled into what we see in Monty Python. And famously, John Cleese was the big star there and then became not quite the big star when he was matched up with other people.
Was BBC TV comedy quite big in 1969? What else did they have on?
It was becoming so. The Rolf Harris show, quite controversially now, was one of the big hits at the time. But the audience was starting to get used to the idea of TV comedy, but they were extremely used to radio comedy, which is why I wanted to bring up, I'm sorry, I'll read that again, shows like The Navy Lark, The Goon Show, Hancock's Half Hour. There was this really rich tradition of radio comedy, both as character and sitcom, but also sketch and the silliness that we see in Monty Python, I think you can track directly back to Spike Milligan and Peter Sellers and The Goon Show.
How did it go down in 1969?
Like a ton of bricks. It was extremely well watched. So 1.5 million viewers watched the first episode, which is absolutely huge for TV at the time. But the audience appreciation rate was 45%, which was quite low. But it was an immediate hit. Nothing had really happened like it on TV before. But it really generated just right throughout its career. I mean, they did 45 episodes of this show. And right through it, they're just absolutely mired in controversy because what they were doing was, by its very nature, anti-authoritarianism.
And did they film it in a conventional manner?
No, it sounds like absolute chaos, Karen. It really brings me out in anxiety. There were so many changes, and there are all of these incredible letters between different members of the BBC's production unit trying to work out what on earth they were supposed to do, including one quite brilliant letter where someone says, if you want something to have an eatable frame, you need to talk to catering, not to props.
Wrong department.
In their first, in one of the first episodes, there was a requisition form to the props department that asks for a selection of bras, 6, panties, 6, tights, 5, and one swastika flag. So you've got to wonder quite what people made of it, especially for an organisation that at the time, although it did have its characters, was pretty much part of the regime.
The first episode was filmed in a pub, I believe. So did they go into the studio after that?
Yeah, so I think it was a mixture of like on-set screened sketches and then ones that they could film in front of an audience. And that does seem to be the format that most British sketch shows still do. I mean, if you look at the Mitchell and Webb look as a kind of a recent example, that's very much what they do. They play sketches to an audience.
And what about here in New Zealand? I remember it well. What was the impact in New Zealand?
Well, it had a fairly big impact throughout the 70s. I'm working slightly blind here, Karen, because I can't find many records of it. So I would really like people to text in 2101 or send us an email just saying what your first interaction with it was. From what I've been able to ascertain anecdotally, lots of people knew about it, but actually seeing it was quite hard to do. But by the end of the 70s, it's a big deal here. And then 1980, of course, well, 1979, we see The Life of Brian.
The film,
the
right.
Film.
And that was such a massive hit in New Zealand, but quite controversial.
Yes, it really was mired in controversy. Christian groups here were extremely frustrated by it. Blasphemy law is still very much a thing in New Zealand at the time. And so requests were made to the censor. There was a petition that had over 12,000 signatures trying to get the Minister of Internal Affairs to withdraw the film from public release. The chief censor at the time eventually came to the decision that it is not blasphemous or sacrilegious. It may be argued that it is in bad taste, but this is a factor which, in terms of the law, I am not required to and cannot take into account, which is a lovely, lovely piece of writing when you're trying to tell 12,000 people to go away.
Great answer.
It's really good, eh?
But blasphemy, was it a common charge in New Zealand at the time?
We had blasphemy law in New Zealand right up until almost the present, Karen. There's a whole bunch of stuff happening last year about removing blasphemy law, which eventually happened. It's been there for a long time, although no one has been prosecuted under it since 1922.
I wonder what you'd have to do to be named a blasphemer.
Well, maybe tying a man to a cross and making him sing a song. I mean, it probably was blasphemous in the in the Christian creed, but whether or not that matters in a country is a whole different matter. So The Life of Brian was kind of this touchstone that really lit up this issue. So what is the role of our censor? And is this a Christian country? It was also an extremely funny film in many ways. And someone who did high school Latin, the sketch of John Cleese instructing Graham Chapman on how to fix his vocabulary and on his graffiti, it remains one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
And he's not the Messiah.
He's not the Messiah.
Should we play that now?
He's just a naughty boy, Karen.
Now, you listen here. He's not the Messiah. He's a very naughty boy. Now, go away.
Who are you?
I'm his mother, that's who.
Behold his mother. Behold his mother. Hail to thee, mother of Christ. Blessed art thou. Hosanna. Always be. Now and always.
Now, don't think you can get around me like that. He's not coming out. And that's my final word. Now, shove off.
It's all coming back to me. What a great movie. And obviously,
yeah, so some of it hasn't dated particularly well, I will say, but there's a lot of comedy there that's really good. And at its heart, it is kind of taking the piss out of the current situation in Britain at the time.
And John Cleese, the Minister of Silly Walks, he's revered in Palmerston North, isn't he?
It's one of my favourite things. There's a compost pit at the Palmerston North dump. which is titled after John Cleese, after he made some extremely disparaging comments about the city in 2005, which I think is a lovely tribute and one that he probably appreciates.
A compost dump at the landfill.
Yeah. So at least it's regenerative, Karen.
Right. Yeah, what did John Cleese say about Palmerston North? He said it was the suicide capital of New Zealand, didn't he? Then went on to say...
He said, if you wish to kill yourself but lack the courage to, I think a visit to Palmerston North will do the trick. Ooh. And I think it's rough, but he's got a real reputation for being acerbic, and that's partly why we're talking about him tonight. But he was one of many members.
I wonder if Palmerston North have forgiven him for that.
I think if he decided to come back and play at the theatre, they would.
We'll ask Palmerston North. Have you forgiven John Cleese? He said he had a thoroughly bloody miserable time. We stayed in a little motel. The weather was grotty. The theatre was a nasty shape and the audience was very strange to play to.
I mean, it doesn't sound great, hey? I've spent some fairly grotty evenings in small town New Zealand. Not that Palmerston North's a small town, but yeah, last thing I want to do is annoy the good people of the Manawatu.
Well, Fred Dagg, John Clark, he came from Palmerston North, didn't he? And he thinks the dump should be named the John Cleese Memorial Tip or the John Cleese Dump or something, doesn't he?
Rest in peace, the great John Clark. I don't know quite what his comments were there, but I think John Clark owes a lot to Monty Python and to John Cleese. I mean, if you want to talk about acerbic, dry, straight men, then you can't go much further than John Clark.
I think John was right, Fred Dagg. The John Cleese Memorial Tip would be a great idea.
I mean, it's a good plaque, right?
Certainly is, and a play on words as well. Great. Well, that's really has led us into the song for tonight, Robert. We couldn't go past Always Look on the Bright Side. I looked at the song and I thought, look, we've all heard it a million times, but it always makes you smile, doesn't it?
What a lovely, lovely song for three convicted criminals dying in a classical era torture device to be singing.
Thank you very much, Robert. And here we go. Monty Python's Flying Circus with Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
Cheer up, Brian. You know what they say. Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, grumble, give a whistle, and this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. Aim.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Come on.
Always look on the bright side of life.
For life is quite absurd. Yes, the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene. Give the audience a grin. Enjoy it. It's your last chance anyhow.
So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep 'em laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And
always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life.
Come on, boy.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life.
available in the foyer.
Always look on the bright side.
Some of us have got to live as well, you know. Alright, it's a lot. Let's get this bloody knock down.
Always
look on the bright side. And change this mantle within 3 weeks. What do you think pays for this rubbish?
Always look on the
bright side. Never make the money back, you know. I told him. I said to him, Bernie, I said, they'll never make that money back. Thank you very much for coming along. Thank you very much for coming along. I think the voiceovers have helped the record enormously.
That's it, is it? I mean, that really is it?
Yes, thanks. That's all we need, thanks.
Okay. We don't want this song, then.
No, this song is a bit de trop, I think. We have plenty of songs on the album anyway, as it happens. Is
who?
£30 all right?
As always, look on the bright side of life, which was written by Eric Idle and featured on the 1979 Monty Python's Life of Brian.